Several weeks ago, I had a request to do a sermon on what happens after we die. And so I made an attempt at that. And as I was preparing that sermon, I had originally planned to include a section on it about the rest that we're promised. And it didn't take far into the sermon to realize that it was going to be too much for one. So I said, well, I'm going to come back later and do a sermon on rest. And when I started that for this week, I soon realized that one sermon wasn't going to get all of that. And I know that a series of sermons won't get it all either, because rest is a huge topic in the Bible. But what I'd like to do today, and then maybe for another couple of Sundays afterward, is to look at the concept of rest in a broad biblical way, to look and see how that idea is introduced very early in the Bible story and continues on to the promise that we're made as the followers of God. And so as we consider that, we're going to go way back to the very first chapter and a little bit of the second chapter of the book of Genesis as we look at this week of creation. As God begins the creation in the bringing of light into the darkness, the separations that occur, the filling of the creation that He's made ultimately with mankind, He does all of that in 6 days, and chapter 1 tells us about that. But that's not the end of the story, though we have an unfortunate chapter break. In chapter 2, He tells us about the seventh day. And on that seventh day, He talks about the rest that's given. And let's just read that together, going down to verse 1 of chapter 2. The text tells us, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished His work that He had done, and He rested on the seventh day from all the work that He had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all His work that He had done in creation." There are several very repetitive phrases there. God is resting from the work. In other words, God has created this magnificent world. And as He looks down on it, He says, it's perfect. There's nothing else for me to add to it. And He ceases from that work. But unlike the 6 days that have followed, we don't find the tag at the end that says the evening and the morning were. We find that for the rest of the days. But in day 7, we don't see that there. No, and the evening and the morning were the seventh day. Why is that? The reason for that is because the way the text is written, it's as if this day is never going to end. It's an eternal rest into which God has now gone. And He says to His human creation, I want you to join me in this rest. And so that's why we don't need that chapter break there. God has given us the picture of the creation, and then the crowning moment of it is, I've finished, I've entered this rest, and now I want my creation to join me within it. So here we have a day that is eternal, a day in which God is picturing He and humanity in paradise. In fact, as we continue on, we kind of have a refocus, and God is now going to give us a picture from a land perspective of creation. And He talks about forming the man and forming a garden and putting the man in it, creating the woman, and man and woman as humanity now living within that paradise setting. This is the picture of the seventh day, where God is saying to humanity, this is where I want you to be with me, and this is what it's going to be like. It'll be absolutely perfect. I'll give you things to do, and I'll give you the strength to do them, and you'll do them to my glory, and you and I will partner in all of this together. And so we have this very beautiful picture presented in Genesis 2 of the people being allowed to go into the Garden of Eden, being given the privilege, if they so choose, to eat from the tree of life and there to live forever with God. That picture is a partnership that is based on the trust that humanity has in God. That the idea of seventh-day rest, the idea of eternal rest, is being given to those who will be loyal to their partner, who will be loyal to the God who has created them. Yet what do we know? We know that this is not a total cessation of work. Oftentimes, when you and I think about rest, we think about stopping something. Maybe we've put in a hard day. You can think about a summer day, maybe out in the yard where you're trying to get things ready, and you've been out there in the blistering heat all day long, and you come in, and you're thinking about the Lazy Boy recliner, and you're going to rest. That's the cessation from labor. That is not the picture that God presents. Rest for God is not where we're going to sit around doing nothing. It's the idea of being in this complete relationship with Him, where everything has been made perfect, and like Adam and Eve, we enter into this partnership, and yes, we're given work to do, but yet it is going to be the kind of work that is blessed by God and made very, very readily available for us in the strength that we're given, in the opportunities that we're given. Everything's focused on that relationship. And if we could end the Bible with Genesis chapter 2, what a fantastic story that would be. That all of humanity has done as God has desired. And we've come into this time of rest. We've entered this seventh day that never ends. But yet we know what chapter 3 houses, don't we? It's the rejection of this. Where although God has given all of these things to Adam and Eve, they try to establish their own way of thinking. To believe that they know better than God, and that what God has prohibited, they are entitled to do. And thus, when they violate that command of God, they are rejected from the garden. God drives them out because they would not enter into that rest with Him. And for the remainder of the Bible story, God is saying, I want you back. So thus we find on that seventh day, a storyline beginning that's still in work today. As God says, I give the same offer of rest to humanity that I gave to my first human creation. And the Bible story explains how God does that. So as we consider that as our foundation, this morning, I want us to hone in on a time when God is going to offer rest to a group of people. A group of people who had an ancestor who God had said, I'm going to bless everyone through you. And so the nation of Israel, long since the time of Abraham, are still enjoying the promise that was given to him. Here they are, their descendants that are huge in number. In fact, we're told in the book of Exodus that they have gone into the land and they have multiplied, echoing that statement that God made to Adam and Eve about being fruitful and multiplying. Yet, they're in a difficult situation. When we open the book of Exodus, the family of Abraham has grown very large, but yet they're in bondage. They're the slaves of the Pharaoh of Egypt. And as God now prepares to offer this group of people the promise of rest, He's actually going to use this pagan Pharaoh as a prophet. He sends Moses in to tell Pharaoh it's time to let these people go. And I want you to notice the statement that Pharaoh makes to Moses. He says, behold, the people of the land are now many. All right, so they've gone forth and they've multiplied. And you make them rest from their burdens. That is absolutely true. That was why God sent Moses to deliver them. But Pharaoh's got the whole wrong idea here. Yet, God is allowing the pagan to speak the truth. God is saying to this people, I am your God. I am faithful to Abraham. I'm going to give you rest from your labors if you will follow after me. And we'll not go through the whole story here, but we remember how he brings them out with a powerful hand, and the plagues of Egypt are sent so that when they cross through the Red Sea, Egypt is a smoldering ruin. God has impacted life, and He's impacted their livelihood, and He's impacted their agriculture, everything. And He's brought the people out of that. To go a little bit deeper into this story, I'd like for us to go to Psalm 95. We're going to begin here, and we're going to kind of work our way backward a bit. But if you've got your Bibles, go ahead and let's look over to Psalm 95. The first part of the psalm I have on the screen, because I want us to pay particular attention to this word rock. It's going to be important for us here in a little while, where God says, O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. So let's break this psalm up a bit as we go through. As we begin the psalm, in the first five verses, we're going to hear all about God as being the Creator. Read with me here, beginning in verse 2. Let us come into His presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to Him with songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. In His hand are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are His also. The sea is His, for He made it, and His hands formed the dry land. That language taking us back to Genesis 1. That here is God who is the vast and great Creator. And the psalmist then is going to continue with this idea, and he's going to say, as the Creator, God deserves worship. Let's look beginning in verse 6. Here the psalmist commends us to come and to worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for He is our God, and we are the people of His pasture and the sheep of His hand. The writer says, for no other reason, God deserves our worship because He made us. But yet it's so much more than that. Here is the rock of our salvation. Here is the one who not only created us but sustained us. And the psalmist says we need to come in and to worship Him. And then follows that by saying that God, as our Creator, certainly does not deserve rebellion. Look in the second part of verse 7. Today, if you hear His voice, do not harden your heart as at Meribah, as on the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. As the psalmist depicts rebellion against God, he's going to take us back to a time with that group that came out of Egypt. That group that even the Pharaoh recognized that God was wanting to give them rest. And he's going to pinpoint there and say, here is what happens when you refuse to accept the rest that I offer to you. And the psalmist then ends that by saying it's going to have its price. And so he closes the psalm with saying, therefore I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Because of their rebellion, because of the testing, they will not enter my rest. So let's go back to the book of Exodus, chapter 17, and let's look and see what happens here at Rephidim as they rebel against God. Though we've got to do some background work before we get there. Yet what we're going to find is that God is now at a point where for a second time, He's going to give them very great blessings of water. But the point He's going to make is, look, you've forgotten the first time that I did this. So let's take a look at that first time. As we back up to chapter 15, I've got this on the screen because I want us to see a couple of points here about it. Here is the first occasion where water is being given to them. It says Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea, so they've crossed over. They went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days into the wilderness. We're talking about deep in the desert here. And found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? Moses cried out to the Lord, and then we have something awfully strange here happening. It says, the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw the tree into the water, and the water became sweet. Some of our English translations play a little havoc with this. You'll sometimes see it a stick or a log or something like that. To see that is missing the entire point, because we need to focus in on a tree here, because this is signaling us back to another story. Those who are in the Genesis class are going to get so tired of this, but it's coming anyway here. We're going to make the point. What tree do we need to think about that brings life? That's what's going on here. God is saying, you need to think about your history. You need to understand that when you're with God, God is going to provide. And we can pay particular attention to what this tree does as Moses maybe hews it down and takes it and throws it into the water. The Lord tells us here that the water became sweet. It was now good. It was now something that was going to bring life, which takes us right back to Genesis 2, where as God is describing the trees in the garden, it says He caused every tree to grow that is pleasing to the sight and good for food. That needed to be in the minds of these people as they saw Moses throw this tree into the water. And what was bitter was made sweet. Where there was chaos, there was now the opportunity for life. And after doing that, the Lord is going to make a very Eden-esque statement, though this isn't a direct quote. It's the same promise that was made to Adam and Eve, where now He says, if you will diligently listen to the voice of the Lord your God and do that which is right in His eyes and give ear to His commandments and keep all His statutes, I will put none of these diseases on you that I put on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer. Just as I heal those waters, I'll heal you. Just as I gave life to Adam and Eve, I'll give life to you. Just as I provided for them, I'll provide for you. And then we kind of come to the clincher of all this. And it says, then they went to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the water. You ever wondered why God felt the need to tell us there were 12 springs and 70 palm trees? It's because those are numbers that have been introduced in the book of Genesis that have deep significance, that God is with you, that God is the provider. And so here they were in the desert, and they're crying out, we have nothing to drink. We're going to die out here. And God says, hold on a minute. I can heal. And here in the middle of the desert, we have an Eden oasis where these people find their life. Ultimately, this is going to point us ahead to passages such as in the book of Isaiah, where God is pictured bringing water into the desert, and where no life was, plants are now growing and flourishing. It's the same idea of God saying, wherever I am, there is life. And when you partner with me, there is life. He had shown them that already. We look in chapter 16. And though they had not learned the lesson, here they are again complaining and murmuring because now they have nothing to eat. We can relate to that. But yet God is going to use this to make a point because they're unwilling to accept the rest that He's given. He's shown them the Eden oasis. He's given them water in the desert. What will prevent them from having food? But yet listen to them. He says, and the people of Israel said to them, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger. The exact opposite of what God had done. God had brought them out of the land of death to give them life. They look at this and say, you brought us into the land of death, where we could have stayed in the land of life and had plenty. We have another Genesis connection, and thank you, Brandon, for a great introduction to this. In verse 4, God says, I'm going to rain down bread from heaven. Where's the last time we've been reading about rain? We go back to the book of Genesis. And so here what we find is God saying, I'm going to put them to the test. I'm going to see if they'll believe me like Noah believed. When God said, I'm going to send rain, not of bread, but of water that's going to destroy the earth, I'm going to see if Noah will trust me enough to know that this water will actually save his life. And so God says, they're going to have plenty. Will they trust me? So let's see what we've got so far. He's brought them out of the land of Egypt with a magnificent show of power. He has crushed their enemies. He's given them an oasis in the desert for water. He's rained down bread from heaven to save them. What are they going to do with that? And this is where we come now to the incident at Rephidim. Let's just read what happens here. After all of this, verse 1 of chapter 17. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" Now that is what the psalmist picked up on in Psalm 95. And he said they had all of these things that they could see, yet here at a time when it looks like there's death, they're not trusting the Lord to give life. And so Moses speaks to them here. And look at what he says. He says, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Very serious charges. Yet note what the Lord tells Moses, verse 4. Moses cried to the Lord, "What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me." And the Lord said to Moses, "Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink." God says the rock is going to provide water. Did you catch the significance of that? With Psalm 95, the rock of our salvation. The psalmist knew exactly what he was doing here. And as he talks about the salvation of the Lord, he's talking about this opportunity at Rephidim where the people had such an opportunity to see God in action, but yet they were not trusting Him, but still God is proving to be their rock of salvation. Yet the problem we see here is rebellion. And we need to make sure we pay attention to verse 7. It says, "He called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarreling of the people of Israel and because they tested the Lord by saying, 'Is the Lord among us or not?'" What has been God's dream since Genesis chapter 1? God and humanity together. And God saying to the people, God saying to all mankind, "If you will be with me, I will be with you." Yet this people have the audacity to ask the question, "Is God here, isn't He?" After all of the signs they had seen, what we understand is that there is no rest for those who do not trust. God had promised this people a land flowing with milk and honey. Eden-esque language. "I'm going to take you to a place where you can have it all." But I want us to notice that on the way, He's offering all these opportunities for rest. But yet this generation is refusing to accept that. So let's take that in this installment of rest and see what we've got. What we understand by all of this is that rest is not just something that's over in the glory land. When one enters into a relationship with God, there is rest in the journey. That's what we're seeing here with the people of Israel. When they are in need, God can provide the Eden. No, there's no problem for Him. He can provide the 12 springs and the 70 palm trees. He can rain bread down from heaven. And so along the way, along the journey, that rest can come. But it can only come when we trust that God is with us. The same thing that God expected of Adam and Eve, the same thing that God expected of the children of Israel, it's what God expects of us. I'm going to give you rest if you believe me, if you pass the test that I'm giving to you. Because all of these opportunities should have great significance for you and me. As Matthew begins the story of Jesus Christ, he gives us a little punch to the ribs. He says, "Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel." And Matthew says, you know what that means? That means God is with us. Let me tell you something. If you were a faithful Jew and you read that, you got it. You cued in to what Matthew is saying to us here, that in the term Emmanuel, it's taking us all the way back to Genesis 1, where God says, I want to be partners with you. I want this relationship with you. I want you in the seventh day with me, resting with me. And though my people thus far have blown it, I've not given up. And here is the proof of that. Here is the bread of life. Here is the living water. Here is God who is with you. And what does Jesus say? Later in Matthew, he records for us this, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." That's true in an eternal sense, but it's also true in the here and now. The idea there is refreshment. The rest that he's describing about is though you're traveling through a desert land and you come to an oasis, you come to a time where you're finding that refreshment. Jesus is saying, when you take my yoke upon you, first of all, it's light, but second of all, it's going to give you that opportunity to find tranquility in the journey along the way. And so what we must understand in this promise is that while God has said, I'm going to give you rest, that does not mean that He's going to remove the challenges. Now that can pose a challenge for us in how we're going to look at that. I have no doubt many of us would have been in the front bleacher seats, murmuring in the desert. We are a people who love to be comfortable. Let the air conditioning go out for a day in July and you would think we had lost everything, right? We murmur and complain. I understand that. But yet God says, I have much higher expectations for you. And if God had it for the children of Israel, in what we have seen with the coming of Emmanuel, God with us, as we have seen with the promise that we'll find refreshment along the way, we've got to be really careful about how we approach these challenges that come. Because when they come, oftentimes they're molding us into kingdom citizens. You know what's interesting? Is a God who had the power to wipe out the superpower of the day, the God who could part the Red Sea, the God who could provide water by throwing a tree in it, the God who could rain bread from heaven, the God who could tell Moses to strike a rock and the water come out, is a God who could have snapped his fingers and immediately transported them from Egypt to Canaan. So why didn't he? They needed the journey. That idea of trusting is something that's learned. It's something that is only going to be seen when you're put to the test. And I'm afraid a lot of times we're missing that point when these things happen to us. We're not going to take this as though we've got to be stoic about it, that we can show no emotion, that we can't have sadness. But what we do have to understand is that when the test comes, God is saying, you know, I'm among you. I'm with you. I can provide. May not be immediately. He may let us get a little thirsty, like the Israelites did. He may allow some rumbles of hunger in our stomachs like He did with Israel, but God is saying, what I'm doing is preparing you to take you into the land of rest where we can get to business with what I've wanted to do all along. I'm just giving you a few little oases along the way to show that in the midst of the journey, I can provide. What we must not do is to believe that God has abandoned us. That's what the devil is whispering in our ear. He's saying, a God who loves you would not allow you to hurt. A God who loves you would not allow these things to happen to you because you just don't do that to people that you love. Wait a minute. God has given us the story. You and I have zero excuse. God has told us. God has shown us through His people. God has said, it may look bad at the moment, but I am with you. And it may very well be that this time is a time where I'm preparing you to be that citizen with me in the land of rest. So then, we need to appreciate those times. There are occasions in our life that are hard, but I am more and more convinced there's occasions in our life where if we think about them, we can see those times of refreshment on the journey, where we can see that God is saying, I can provide for you. I can take care of you. And if we ever take the focus off of us and on Him, it's going to be a whole lot easier to see. Where maybe we're going through a time or we're having some difficulty of health or something of that nature, and it just seems like the world is crashing in, and we look back on that time later and we see all of these things God has done to get us through it. I'm afraid sometimes we're a little scared to talk like that. We're a little afraid to say that for fear someone might misunderstand. But I tell you what, when we read the book of Exodus, I think we get a strong picture that God is saying, I want you to recognize what I'm doing. So let's do that. Because it's these moments of rest that are the down payment for the time to come. When we'll enter into that seventh day, and when you and I will be there with God. So we trust that God is with us, even when it may appear He's not. That we do not grumble. That we do not go back to the days when people grumbled and rebelled against God. May we all keep that promise of Jesus in mind. I'm going to give you refreshment for your soul. That's true now, and that most definitely will be true in the time to come. Okay, so don't forget anything I've said until next week. And we're going to pick up with part two of this, and we're going to see another instance from Israel and where God is trying to teach them this lesson. Thank you so much for your very good attention this morning. Let me just close our study this morning by saying, promise of rest is there. That's what baptism's all about. You pass through the water, just like the children of Israel. You're going to leave the enemy on the other side. Now, is he ever going to try again? Yeah. But you've got God with you now. Because when you pass through the water, you're saying, I trust. I'm convinced that by His grace, God's giving me the opportunity to enter into His rest. And you're going to have trials. I don't want anybody to feel that that's sugar-coated. There are going to be things that happen, bad things that happen, if we're given any amount of time afterwards. But those are going to be occasions where God's going to let us know that He's with us and that that's a down payment for things to come. Let's not turn against God, and for certain, let's not squander the opportunity through apathy. That generation did lose their chance after a while. After many opportunities, God finally said, I loathed that generation. What hard language. But yet here is a God who tried over and over to get them to come to Him, but they refused. Don't be a part of that generation, is what the psalmist tells us. This morning, if you're ready to respond to that opportunity to pass through the waters into salvation, God has given you that opportunity. you can come forward and make your confession of faith before this group and let them join with you in that, or we can do it in private. It makes no difference whatsoever, because it's a journey you and God are taking. Maybe, though, you're struggling with that, and problems have come up. It's tested your faith. They do for all of us. If we can pray with you about that, we'll do so. If there's sin in your life that we can go with you to the throne room of heaven and pray about, we'll do that as well. Let's take advantage of the rest that God has promised through His Son and our Savior. You can come now as we stand and sing.